from the Lynn DeGrant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois. This is the closing market report. It is the 17th day of October 2024. I'm Extension's Todd Gleason. Coming up, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Matt Bennett from AgMarket.net. Frayn Olson will join us again, this time around, to talk about trade, tariffs, exports, and renewable diesel. And then as we wrap up our time together, we'll discuss the weather forecast, too, that with Mike Tenorm of T-Storm Weather on this Thursday edition of the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Medium, online, on demand, at willag.org. December corn today settled at $4.06¾. That was 2 cents higher. The March at $4.21¼, 3/4 higher. The May contract at $4.28¾ unchanged. November beans at $9.88¾, up 8¾. January at $9.98, up 4. And the March at $10.09¾, 2 higher. Bean meal futures up $4.40 at $3.18.10. The bean oil at $42.59, 91 cents higher. And wheat futures for the soft red up 4.5 cents at $5.89½, and the hard red December at $5.96, up 7¼. Matt Bennett at AgMarket.net is out of the office. However, his colleague Jim McCormick now joins us. Thanks for pilling in, Jim, on short notice. I appreciate that a lot.
No problem, Todd. Thanks for having me on.
So I was looking at the charts as it's related to the soybeans, and I made note that today they posted a hook up, so they had a lower close and a higher high and a higher settlement. They've been building that head and shoulders top down here at the bottom of the market, actually. And I'm wondering whether you've talked to Brian Split a little bit about that. He's your chartist, or what you just think about this close in the soybeans, because it and corn both managed a pretty good finish today.
Well, it's definitely a good finish. I mean, we were technically oversold, Todd, after the last couple of weeks of hard selling. We got a nice little rebound today. We have not taken out the downtrend line that we've, you know, the monthly downtrend line we've been in since this market topped here, pretty much right there at the very end of September. So I think right now it's more of a technical correction. If you look at really what drove the trade today, it was the bull spreading. December corn, like you mentioned, was up 2. March corn up 3/4. July corn actually down 3/4. So they're buying the D, selling the back. Beans, it was even more aggressive. Settled out. November beans were up about 8¾. Jan only up 4. March up 2. July up 1¾. So somebody's very aggressively buying that front, selling the back. That shows us a sign of demand there. And on the beans, we are hearing like there are some end users or some dealer sellers that actually are having a hard time getting a hold of good quality beans due to all the problems and the hurricanes and the Delta. And they're kind of bidding up aggressively in the spaces as well as the spreads as they're trying to pull the better quality beans out of the north to fill, you know, to blend off. But as harvest is wrapping up here in the north, they're having a hard time getting their hands on the beans.
Yeah, so logistically, as I'm thinking about what you're telling me, it used to be that the hog producers that were in those Carolinas would bring most of their soybeans and corn both in from, and poultry that is, from Ohio, Indiana, rail it in. And then soybeans, of course, began to move into the southeastern states. They really pumped up their acreage. I guess they probably changed in order logistically to pick those up. And now they're bidding up at, I suppose, to try to move those by rail to that southeastern corridor for production.
Well, they are. I mean, that's, like you said, they're trying to do it. And if you look at where maybe some of the beans are a little bit disappointing, Todd, it was probably more in the east where this warm, dry August just kind of really shut down the crop a little bit earlier in smaller beans. But, you know, we've seen some just weird things going on in the cash market right now, quite bluntly. In southwest Missouri, an area bordering Arkansas, they're paying 60 over the corn, 60 plus basis over corn, for corn, 60 over the D's, excuse me. When you go to northeast Missouri on the border of Illinois, it's the opposite. It's 70 under the D's. Just two different planets, same state. And part of that's just logistics. Harvest is done down in Missouri. It's going on here. There's no freight available to move corn because everyone's kind of filled up with beans trying to figure out what to do with this big bean harvest. It seems like, Todd, a lot of the producers moved the beans to the commercial sector and they're holding on to the corn this fall.
What are you telling producers when and if they call or by text and email more likely today about marketing both corn and soybeans?
Well, right now, I think the situation, if you could hold on to your corn on farm and beans on farm, it's probably something pragmatic to do. I do think odds are high we will get a rebound sometime into the winter, springtime. We're definitely going into this winter very, very dry. It's a La Nina year. You're definitely going to hear people worry about dryness issues going this spring and next year. So I think you will have that opportunity. On the other hand, if you cannot store that product on farm and you have to put it into the commercial market, we're telling people to do the math. In a lot of cases, it may be cheaper to just let the grain go and maybe reown it with an option strategy down the line. As for the overall crop and the beans, they lowered the bean crop a little bit. My guess is it gets a little bit smaller, Todd, but the fact is it's really going to come down to Brazil. Brazil has transitioned from the dry season to the wet season right on time. If this continues to build out through their normal growing season, they have trendline yields. You will look at world stocks to use. That's the second highest lever ever. Growth stocks, ending stocks, highest ever. That's not $10 beans. It's probably closer to $9, if not lower. So we're all playing that South American weather game. So, there still is an immense amount of risk, even with today's bump up in the market.
Thank you very much, Jim.
Oh, thanks, Todd. All right. Thank you for having me on, Todd.
You're so welcome. That's Jim McCormick. He is with AgMarket.net. Joined us here on the Closing Market Report for this Thursday afternoon. Find us online at willag.org. Our theme music, by the way, is written, performed, produced, and courtesy of Logan County, Illinois farmer Tim Gleason. Earlier this week, we had a conversation with Extension Agricultural Economist from North Dakota State University, Frayne Olson, about the agricultural markets. In that, I had a longer conversation, which we'll hear the rest of today, as it's related to renewable diesel, the export market, imported used cooking oil from China, the RFS, and tariffs. We'll start with the two new soybean crushing plants in that state.
So just to kind of recap, there were these, the plants that are operating right now have been on the drawing boards for quite a while. We've had rumors and discussions about it actually for several years. And I think my viewpoint is that the interest in renewable diesel, and in particular the additional demand for the soy oil, was kind of the tipping point that finally said, yes, this is a project that will now move forward. So I don't know that it was all 100% driven by renewable diesel, but that was obviously a key component to it. To my knowledge, yes, they are finding homes for both the meal as well as the soybean oil. A lot of the soybean oil, especially from the ADM plant, which is the first one that was operational a little over a year ago, is going to Western North Dakota. There's a small diesel fuel refinery that was converted into making renewable diesel. Again, my understanding is that those gallons are still being delivered into the California market. Obviously, pricing and price differentials are a little bit different than we saw when that plant was first initiated. So the used cooking oil that's coming in, a lot of it from China, which is correct, but from other sources, is displacing some of that, what will we call the virgin oil, the oil that hasn't been used for something else. And that's putting some downward pressure on soybean oil prices, because there was, some very high expectations for the demand base coming out of the California market. It's there. It's just we're finding some alternative oils that we can use as the base for that. And used cooking oil has a very different carbon footprint than let's say soybean oil that was crushed and goes directly into the refining process for renewable diesel. So there's some carbon math behind there that we have to also keep in mind. As you said, it gets very complicated very, very quickly. But to my knowledge, yep, the plants are up and operating. They're finding homes for the oil and the meal. Some of it I do know is going into the California market, but I don't know the exact quantities.
Yeah, so I do want to ask a couple of other questions about it as I've been thinking through this. There have been, within the farm community, lots of why is this happening? Why doesn't the U.S. just stop importing the used cooking oil? And as I'm was thinking through what the advanced biofuels portion of the RFS would say, is that it opened it up in hopes of developing a an advanced biofuel sector. It did not close off, I believe, in any form, the import of the feedstock to make that happen. And it would be difficult, I suppose, at this time, particularly to put a tariff on without triggering some other backlash from those nations that would be exporting the used cooking oil into the United States. And so we're kind of caught in between a rock and a hard place. The RFS puts forward the advanced biofuels or the low-carbon diesel functions out of the States. And I'm just wondering how you view the whole policy structure.
Well, okay, so it's a really great question, and actually it's a little more complicated than you even introduced it. So at the national level, there's a renewable fuel standard, which is part of what you have been talking about. But the main driving force, especially behind renewable diesel, is actually the laws that have been implemented within the state of California. So California has their own separate carbon standards, their carbon emissions, and their own kind of accounting process that you're using to make sure that the carbon and carbon flows get accounted for properly. Now, other states, for example, Washington State and Oregon, have also adopted similar kinds of laws. But the big driver, because of just the fuel consumption, has been California. So the California Air Resources Board, or CARB, is actually really behind a lot of these decisions. And at least right now is from what I'm understanding, the kind of the driving force behind some of these uses for not only the used cooking oil, but also for other sources of vegetable oil. So we have two layers of policies that are kind of interacting here. One of them is at the state level, in particular in California, and the other is obviously at the national level. And the politics gets to be a little bit different, whether you're looking at the state or at the national portion of that. So the part of the reason that there's such an interest in the used cooking oil is because it is used cooking oil. So when you do the carbon math, which is my terminology for this, because it's a waste product, they don't count the carbon that is going to be used other than the energy required to convert the used cooking oil into renewable diesel. So the carbon footprint for used cooking oil is substantially smaller than the carbon footprint for vegetable oil that's been grown and processed into a viable feedstock and then converted, because that used cooking oil has already been used for something else. It's considered a waste product, and therefore the assumption is that it's going to be either dumped into a landfill or somehow recycled. Okay, so if you're using that as the feedstock, it's a, air quotes, waste product, and it has a much lower carbon footprint. So there's two pieces to this that are benefits for using used cooking oil. Number one is the cost, you know, for the raw product coming in, but the other part is obviously the carbon output or the carbon footprint of that particular fuel. So this gets to be really, really complicated really fast, and there's a lot of dynamics that are going on behind the scenes. As far as putting some kind of tariff or kind of some restrictions on the importation of the used cooking oil, that's something that's obviously being talked about from a policy standpoint at both the federal level as well as the California state level. But it just hasn't gathered enough momentum yet to actually be implemented, because as everybody knows, there's the trade tensions already, in particular between the United States and China. And there's some concerns about, well, if we start pushing these limits too hard, what are the response going to be? And right now it's all being held up within that political debate.
And we've seen what China has done when policies are in place. For instance, with the Canadian rapeseed, I don't exactly recall what happened there, but they reacted fairly quickly. They have not reacted, actually, to the Biden administration's policies related to EVs in the United States, but most expect that'll happen not long after the election, I guess.
I would suspect. And that was really the retaliation that the Chinese had against the Canadian canola industry. Not long after the United States announced their 100% tariff on Chinese electric vehicles, the Canadians followed with a very similar policy. It wasn't long after that that the Chinese said, okay, if you're going to put this tariff on our electric vehicles, we're going to put a basically 100% tariff on Canadian canola. And the reason that becomes important for the Canadians is that about 25% of all of their production ends up being exported into China. So when you suddenly take out 20%, 25% approximately of their demand base, that makes a substantial impact on product flows as well as pricing. And now they, as you noted, the Chinese have not retaliated against the U.S. yet. But again, as you said, I would agree with the assessment that that's probably coming, and it will heavily depend upon the election and how the politics plays out after that.
It is the tit for tat that normally takes place in trade policy.
Yes, that is the tools that are used in today's world of trade.
And on this side of the oceans, generally, those can be heavily targeted to the things that matter a great deal to our export markets, particularly in agriculture. I meant generally the United States export markets, but because we're so heavily dependent on ag exports, those usually get targeted by the other nations.
Yep, those are things that that are very at the top of the list when it comes to the ability to retaliate and say let's try and see if we can cause some pain to the other party. And again, we export a lot, and a lot of other countries depend upon U.S. supplies for that. So, the challenge we're facing both politically as well as for the other countries. Obviously, when China puts, for example, a tariff on U.S. agricultural products, which increases the prices, then what happens to their product flows? What happens to their prices internally? Are there other countries that can step up and backfill the missing or the reduced exports? And if so, that's going to be at a higher price as well. So both the exporting country as well as the importing country get hurt on this. And it's a matter of who has the political will and the financial reserves to be able to make it last.
Frayn Olson is an agricultural economist with North Dakota State University Extension. On that note, a newly released study from the Illinois Corn Growers shows that corn and soybean farmers would be the losers of any upcoming trade wars to the tune of hundreds of millions of tons. The study forecasts Brazil and Argentina would claim the lost market share, likely lost to American farmers for decades. The study specifically investigated the impacts of another potential U.S.-China trade war in which China responds to U.S. punitive tariffs by imposing retaliatory tariffs on corn, soybeans, and soybean products, as would be expected given the 2018 Trump administration trade war and overall historic precedent. Exports of both corn and soybeans are important to U.S. farmers, but critical to the bottom lines of Illinois farmers. About half of Illinois' corn crop is moved out of state on average, with the majority of those shipments destined for overseas markets via barge to the Gulf of Mexico or by rail to Mexico. Jeff Skates, the chairman of the Illinois Corn Marketing Board and farmer in Shawneetown, Illinois, says corn and soybeans are a prime target for tariffs as the top two export commodities for the U.S. As the largest exporting state in the country, Illinois farmers can expect to pay an extremely heavy price. Mike Tenura is now here. He's the president and CEO at T-Storm Weather. Hi, Mike. Thanks for being with us.
Hey, Todd. Thanks for having me here today.
Let's talk about some of the growing regions across the planet. We've been following what's been happening in South America, particularly in Mato Grosso, where in that center west region, it appears they're finally getting some rainfall.
Yeah, they are. They're tapping into some of the monsoonal type rains that they get at this time of the year, and those are going to continue for a while. A number of cool fronts are going to move into central Brazil going forward, and each one of those will produce showers and thunderstorms. We're looking for rainfall in the range of 3 to 5 inches over the next 2 weeks, and that's about double their normal for this time of the year. And that'll help out with all the soybean planting that's starting up as we speak. Keep in mind, Todd, and we've talked about this many times over the last month, they have a distinct dry season and they have a distinct wet season. It's just a matter of when for the rainy season to start, and that is now in progress.
In Argentina, will this rain cross in those places as well and maybe relieve the drought?
Well, they're being affected by a different weather pattern, but it's a favorable one for rains for them. The main jet stream is essentially lined up across Argentina, and that's not going to move a whole lot over the next 10 days. and that will allow for several chances for rain going forward. They have seen some nice totals over the last week, and we think they'll see some better totals next week. Once you put all that together, it'll actually look like a pretty nice October for them. But the problem is that we have a drought in place that started in April. So if you think about how long ago that was, even a two-week period of rain is not going to wipe that out. Once we get beyond next week, it does look a little bit dry again. And that's why we're still a little bit concerned that this is not an end to their drought. It is certainly going to help out and buy some extra time for things to change. But at least for the moment, we have some nice rains on the way, but we'll still be talking about drought in November.
We're now in the second half of the month of October. Things have cooled off here in the United States. Will it stay that way?
It's not. This is an unbelievable pattern. We essentially turned unusually warm around September 10th, and besides this cold snap over the last few days, it's been unabated warmth since then. Now, it is going to turn real warm again over the next 2 days, and there's very few signs that this is going to break. The jet stream is going to get a little wavy as we move into the future, and that always means that we're seeing some cold air move around. But at this point, it doesn't look like we're going to see a true blast of cold air anytime soon. That is very likely going to set the stage for one of the warmest September-October periods on record in the central U.S. And we'll see how it all pans out, but at least at this point, Todd, it looks like we're going to average around 8 to 12 degrees warmer than normal over the next 2 weeks, and that's even with today's cold weather.
Any rainfall in those 2 weeks?
Well, we're not going to see a whole lot in the Corn Belt until maybe 7 to 10 days from now. A cool front will move through, and that should produce a little rain, but we're not overly excited about that. The one thing that we are a little excited about is what's happening further west. If you think about the plains, and if you were to look at them from the south and look straight north, and you had the magic ability to see the elevation, it wouldn't actually be flat. Most people think of the plains, and even all the central U.S., is being flat, but the plains are actually sloped. The western part of the plains in Colorado are at around 5,000 to 6,000 feet in elevation, while areas to the east in parts of eastern Nebraska and eastern Kansas are only at around 800 feet. So it's about a 1 mile difference. The setup that we have coming up this weekend is an unusual one, where we have a sustained feed of easterly winds that are developing. If you can get easterly winds like that to develop over a long period of time, of say 2 to 3 days, which is what's starting up now, that essentially causes all that air that's starting out in the eastern plains to rise up about 5,000 to 6,000 feet, saturate, and produce rain. This is called orographic lift, and it's a unique situation to the plains. And that's going to bring some real nice rains to about a third of the hardwood winter wheat crop. 1 to 2 inches is plausible this weekend alone just from this event, and that's about a month's worth of rain in 2 days. So even though they're very dry now, things will look a little bit better for them a few days from now. But we need to remember that once that system moves into the Corn Belt, all the rain goes away because the elevation is essentially flat. And because of that, all that rain is going to dissipate.
Thank you for the information and the explanation. I really appreciate that.
Yeah, sure thing.
We'll talk with you again next week. That, of course, is Mike Tenura. He is with T-Storm Weather. That's tstorm.net online. You've been listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. We're online at willag.org.